Well, thank you again for joining this evening so that we can sit, practice together. Just as we were beginning, someone made mention of the retreat. So yeah, we had the ICD had the retreat up at Big Bear Retreat Center. I'm just looking around to see if anyone else was there. If, well, Ruhl, of course, you were there, and not sure if anyone else who's in our group this evening. But I would say in my estimation, it went very well. It's a wonderful facility. I know for some of us who were at retreat a couple of years ago, which was a really good retreat, but maybe a bit more rustic in nature. This one, that it's very, very well developed and conducive to meditation retreat center. It's very well thought through. It's abundantly staffed. The food is good, all of that stuff. So that's my little plug for Big Bear Retreat Center and ICD to do retreat. We're looking already to return there somewhere around this time next year. We're gonna explore that. It was an interesting retreat for me in the sense of I got to do retreat because we had Mary and Ian and Valerie there as well teaching. So it was well distributed in terms of teaching responsibilities. Other retreats that I've taught at Yokoji and places, when you teach, it's quite a lot of work and responsibility, very active, and you don't get to do much sitting. But for this one, I got to do quite a lot of meditation, and yeah, because more of the Vipassana style. Those 45-minute sitting periods, I usually just sit the 30-minute Zen period, so 45 minutes, I was having to rotate back to a chair, because 45 minutes on the cushion was really, really testing my legs. But it was a rich retreat, and an interesting exploration for me, continuing to blend to some Vipassana teachings and Zen teachings, bringing Zen into Vipassana and vice versa, which is a project I've been involved in one way or another for some years now. That's interesting. We could speak really in generalities and say that some traditions, maybe Vipassana, Tibetan, Theravadan, secular mindfulness, more emphasis on method and approach to practice, right? And in Zen, less method and more emphasis on direct experience. And one isn't better than the other. It's really a question of where you are in your practice and where your affinity, I think where our affinity lies. And that affinity can change over time too. I think in when it goes well, then the more method-based approaches to meditation and Dharma can really benefit from an infusion of Zen. It's like Zen's like the hot sauce on the on the method-based practices. A little splash of Zen. And then for Zen, sometimes in Zen, there's a real shadow with it. It's all about direct experience and immediacy. And then so some of the practice elements and the method elements, that maybe they get passed over. So Zen, I feel like in Zen practice can use some method and some practice, a real underpinning of the Buddhist way. And the other traditions, some of the Zen flavor. I brought up a koan on the retreat, and I was going to bring the same koan up this evening. Hopefully, it's a little different every time you bring these koans up. So for Rule and anyone else who was at the retreat, you know, stay with me. It's not going to be the same talk. It's impossible to give the same Dharma talk. I don't remember what I said anyway, to be honest. But I thought this might be an interesting topic for Dharma this evening. And I'll speak to it, and I want to make sure I leave time for any for question, for comment, for some reflection, anything that you'd like to bring to it too. It's quite a famous koan case from a collection called the Gateless Gate. Right, the Gateless Gate. That title itself is a very Zen flavor, right? The Gateless Gate. The gate that is not a gate. Sometimes called the Gateless Barrier. This is case 19, and it's called Ordinary Mind is the Way. So Joshu asked Nansen, what is the way? Nansen said, ordinary mind is the way. Joshu said, should I try to direct myself toward it? Nansen said, if you try to direct yourself toward it, you will move away from it. Joshu said, if I don't try, how can I know the way? Nansen said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is blankness. If you truly reach the genuine way, it is like great space, vast and open, nothing obstructed. How could there be right and wrong in it? At these words, Joshu had sudden realization. So, Joshu, he's young in this interaction, apparently, somewhere around 20 years old, and already was a practitioner in the Zen tradition, had some experience, and he comes to study with a teacher called Nansen. And Nansen is a justifiably famous figure in Chan Zen, one of the principal teachers of the Tang Dynasty. Joshu would go on to be perhaps the most famous Zen teacher of since Bodhidharma of the Sixth Patriarch. Like, Joshu is very, very famous in Zen. Dogen Zenji would refer to Joshu as Old Buddha, which is, you know, like an affectionate honorific. He only called his teacher Tendo Nyojo and Joshu Old Buddha. Those are the ones who got that kind of affectionate honorific. So Joshu's held in very high regard. Here he is as a young person, goes to see Nansen and asks, what is the way? The word that's translated into way here is most likely is Tao. Like, what is Tao? Or what is reality? What is this? What is the world? What is this life? Right, there's different things that we could put in there, like any kind of word that points at the wonder that we're living in, like the world and everything that's here, and the way in this case would be more than just what's here, but the right side up way of understanding it. Right, that would be the way of a Tao, like to be able to see reality as it is. Like in the Buddha's teaching, for instance, in the Eightfold Path, number one in the Eightfold Path is right view, sometimes called right understanding, right? To see things as they are. And from there, the rest of the Eightfold Path unfolds. First, you need to see things as they are and have a correct view, see reality. And so Joshu's asking, what is that? What is the way? And what is the way of Zen? And Nansen says, ordinary mind is the way. Which is true. But to just say it, you know, we could just say that, well, your ordinary mind is the enlightened mind. The ordinary way is the enlightened way. Right. But just to hear those words, it's not enough to hear those words. It wasn't enough for Joshu at that time. Right? Often as Dharma practitioners, or just as human beings, we're all human beings slowly becoming Buddhas. That's for practice, whether that's Theravada or Mahayana or any of the lineages. You know, we take refuge and confidence in the Buddha's original exclamation on becoming enlightened, where he says, I, the great earth, all beings, are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened ones of thusness. Sometimes it's recounted as, I, all beings, simultaneously attain the way. The Buddha says that enlightenment includes everybody and all things, and everyone is that awakening. And the difference is if we can't testify to that as the truth, it isn't because we're not that, it's because we haven't yet realized we're that. Right? So Dogen is talking about realized potential, right? Unlocking the potential, and everyone has the capacity to be a Buddha, but only a few people fully realize that capacity, the Buddha being one of them, right? And in our own tradition, in Dharma traditions, you maybe point to somebody once every 100 years, a couple of 100 years, somebody comes along who might get called old Buddha, like Joshu or Dogen or you know, several people. I think, you know, somebody like Thich Nhat Hanh would be an example of somebody who several hundred years hence, if we're all here and, you know, well, not us, but you know what I mean, just broadly the human race, but people would remember him, right? So fully realizing our potential, we could say, yeah, then you become a Buddha. So ordinary mind is the way. Joshu doesn't say, got it, chief, right? And then he's all good. That can happen. There's a koan where someone who is not a Buddhist comes to see the Buddha and asks a Buddha a similar question about what is the deepest meaning, you know, how a question like that. And the Buddha just remains sitting silently. And the questioner makes a bow and says, and basically says, thank you, all good. You know, he's good, got it. And he's gone and never seen again. Right? So maybe some people can take a teaching like ordinary mind is the way. But Joshu has follow-up questions. He says, should I try to direct myself toward it? And so this is, right, trying to work out how do we become more enlightened? How do we become more awake? How do we become more realized? It's a good question. Like, okay, you seem to have this understanding. Can you please, you know, drop a few breadcrumbs here and you know, do me a solid? Like, how do I realize what you've realized, perhaps? Right, this is Joshu asking Nansen. Should I direct myself toward it? Direct oneself toward the way. Do we see, like, already the problem with that question? How do I direct myself toward reality or toward the way? Like, where is that? Which way is it? North, south, east, west, up or down? Which way should I be pointing? Nansen says, if you try to direct yourself toward it, you will move away from it. Any long-term Dharma practitioner, meditator, or sitter can taste the truth of this statement. How, if you've tried to get enlightened, has that worked out? Right? It's like, how much progress, right? It's like trying to get enlightened, trying to reach for it. We see immediately the problem of the kind of the acquiring mind, right? The human beings, we have this acquiring mind that wants to get things, right? It's like where a lot of our clinging comes from, is the acquiring mind, wanting to reach for things, wanting to gather more in, right? So if we apply that to the Dharma or to the way, if I trying to direct yourself toward thing, something, denotes that it must be separate somehow. I go, here's me here, here's enlightenment over there. Which way do I go to get over there? And Nansen says, well, if you move toward it, you move away from it. At the retreat, I brought up the example of the horizon, you know, which you can use as a metaphor for awakening. We're all familiar with the horizon, right? You can, and sometimes a horizon is more striking than another time. You know, today's been a little overcast and cloudy and maybe a little chance of rain. And the horizon is really looking towards north, towards the mountains. Towards the Joshua Tree mountains, that way. It's all sort of indistinct and blurred. You can't, like, the horizon just looks like something nebulous. Often here in the desert, the horizon's just very striking and clear. Beautiful blue sky, peaks, mountains, desert, right? And you see the horizon in that way. But no matter how the horizon is made up, that's a horizon. Whatever we say, whether we say it's nice or looks great or not, you know, or whatever we say about it, is always our preferring mind, trying to categorize and compare things. In the same way with awakening and realization, it is the horizon of our experience now. This is, right, so wherever we are, even in the room, the horizon is right here. This is the horizon of realization. And if you go toward it, you move away. It moves away from you in the sense of you don't catch up to the horizon. You don't get the other side, right? It's like trying to reach the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. It's looking for something that's hit on the other side of where you are. If you try to direct yourself toward it, you'll move away from it. Or you could take this another way. If you try to direct yourself towards something called enlightenment, then all we do is create ideas and projections around what that is. And that moves us away from it. Because now we're creating a simulacrum of life, right? And we do this in other ways other than enlightenment too. We can conjure up and project ways. Well, if I just had this and had that, and then this happens, I'll be happy. Right? It's a very human thing for us to do. Kind of helps keep us motivated, but it's also something of a delusion. If I move towards it, it'll move away from us. It's like that way with satisfaction. If we can be satisfied by things, events, people, things that we can quantify, you know, and we think that those will satisfy, when you get there, you find often that they don't. Right, this is like Buddhism 101, is seeing like material things, and anything that appears in the world in form is not dependable and ultimately not satisfying. So if you try to direct yourself toward it, you may move away from it. Enlightenment, in way, awakening, realization, these words that we use to point to something, well, it's not pointing to something. This is where language is difficult. It's not something. It's not something outside or something separate. It's all of this as it is now, shorn of our projections, hopes, and ideas around it. That is often the construction, our constructed view of realization of reality is often what covers our eyes and obscures where we are. So we're looking for something else. In the Oxford, in the 10 Oxford in pictures, which are well worth looking up if you've never seen them, it's a pictorial view of the practice of Zen in 10 pictures. In it, well worth looking at. Like, pictures are very, have a certain power beyond words, right? A visual image. So it's like the 10 Oxford in pictures. A very, really good formula for exploring the work of Zen, of the practice of Dharma. I think it's in the first one. So if anyone's looking it up and you're like, that's not the one you're talking about, then I got mixed up. But first one or second one, I think it's the first one. The ox herder, the character who's, you know, me and you, right? In the ox herding pictures, is looking for the ox, is looking for their true nature. The ox in the ox herding pictures is our true nature, our realized Buddha nature. But when he looks for the ox, the footprints of the ox are right in front of his nose, are right in front of him. But in the picture, he's looking over here. And this is the example, the pictorial example of what we do often in spirituality or in Zen or in Dharma practice. We're kind of looking over here for it because the most obvious place right in front, we always discount that. Because what's right in front of us is demeaned by our conditional experience of it. You know, I'm not excited. The first time when we moved to this apartment, I was quite excited to have an adult-sized kitchen. You know, it's like a real refrigerator and a gas stove. Like, well, hey. But now when I walk in every day, I'm just not... Every day that I walk in, I don't go, oh my gosh, look at this kitchen. You know, it's like, isn't it amazing? I'm well into the taking it for granted stage. Right? That comes in almost immediately. In our environment, when we get used to it, this is part of our human condition. We take for granted the things that don't threaten or excite us. If we're not excited by it or threatened by it, we discount it. As a human being. But as an emerging Buddha, as a Bodhisattva, as a Dharma practitioner, we practice and learn, we let go of the conditioned ideas, our conditioned views, and try to, like, through the practice, defog that mirror. Defog the mirror which got fogged by our taking for grantedness, and I know what that isness, and I've been here beforeness, right? And all of that view is effectively disrupted by the practice of Zazen. So don't think that, you know, for a moment, it's like when you just sit, and I give these pointers of let go of a preference system, and you, maybe we do that to some degree, and then it's like, okay, now what's next? Okay, use the restroom and have a Dharma talk. It's like, don't underestimate the power of transformation that is taking place when you sit authentically. It is sweeping cobwebs. That practice is defogging the mirror. It's helping to see through the projection that we put on the world. We're often looking through our conditioned view and meeting reality through a distortion. Often, like, just a very slight distortion, and one that is still very functional, but still something of a distortion. That's the human condition. Okay, so if you try to direct yourself toward it, you will move away from it. So we have to drop all of our projections and ideas about what enlightenment is, realization is, awakening, any of these terms. Throw all of that out, and then you won't try and direct yourself toward it because you've forgotten what that is. There's no need to look for that. Rather, instead, like in the Oxurden pictures, look at the footprints right in front of you. But Joshu says, if I don't try, how can I know the way? So you're not easily dissuaded and very smart, you know, and just like really wants to be precise here. If I don't try to understand the way, then how can I know the way? Like, how will I realize it? Don't I have to make effort? And here's like, this brings up the wonderful irony of Zen practice and Dharma practice in general. You have to work very hard to attain non-attainment. You have to work very hard to arrive at a place of gaining nothing at all, right? It's just very counterintuitive in that way. Like, a certain amount of sitting, a lot of sitting in Dharma practice is really just wearing things through. It's wearing things out. It's like the way that I hold the mind, the way that I describe reality, the way that I think that I might have a handle on any of this at all. That is what's getting worn thin. The way you understand, right? The true understanding is the loss of understanding, is when everything kind of falls through and you're left just exactly where you are, as you are. If I don't try, how can I know the way? Nansen says, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. So that's out the gate. He's just, look, if you intellectualize this practice, if you think you're going to, let me just tell you what the Dharma is, and then, you know, have some eloquent language around that, or just try and define and fix. No, clearly, words don't reach reality. They describe reality. They're an approximation of reality. Like the word before, I said the word, you know, horizon. How can that word actually describe the complexity of the view that we see when we look at the horizon? Like the word mountain. You know, it's just, you look at a mountain. Oh, it's a mountain. Well, yes, but also much more than that label. And so much more a person, right? We may know people and you know somebody and you know their name and somebody might ask you and it's like, yeah, I know who that person is. I know what that person's like. And we got a kind of little go-to cheat sheet for that person is A, B and C and a little bit of D. And that's them. And of course, but that's just not, it's just this wildly inaccurate approximation. Same thing about this one here. We might imagine like, oh, I really know myself through and through. But that self is changing from day to day. And it can never be pinned down and described accurately in words. So the way is not a matter of knowing. You can't grasp it. And not knowing is blankness. So that's like kind of like the not knowing of just like, don't know. With no inquiry and no ideas, but just kind of a, I don't know. Or like a don't know, which is the absence of an answer. Like I would know if I could know of an answer arrived, but I don't know. Right? That's not any use here either. He says, now he describes what it is to reach this realization. And Nansen is speaking from experience here, right? As someone who's practiced for decades and has really worn some things through, he says, if you truly reach the genuine way, so if you gain real, true, authentic realization, it is like, the way is like great space. It's vast and open with nothing obstructed. How could there be any right or wrong in it? So Nansen here is describing the mind of Nansen, the mind of Joshu, the mind of you, the mind of me, the mind of everyone, as fundamentally at its core, being vast, empty, and without limit. Now, that can be experientially true when we stare up into the night sky and look 10,000 light years away and then more. You know, we can hear sounds from miles away. We can experience, you know, without edge or a hard limit there. But if we really see authentically, much more than intellectually, but intellectually can take us a certain way with this. If we realize that we are the whole world and the whole world is us, and really swallow that down, not just intellectually, but experientially too, to see that truly nothing is separate and apart from anything else in this entire cosmos, which is testified to by science at this point, long after these words were written. But also just in our experience, we have this Buddha, what we call Buddha mind or Buddha nature, this awake nature. The same awareness that is expressing itself through me is the same awareness that is revealing itself through you. That's how we're able to see and communicate and meet each other here, stood or sat in this case, in empty space. Like, how extraordinary. We're sitting in our armchairs, you know, on a continental landmass, rotating on a planet, spinning around the center of a galaxy in a random corner of infinite space. That's pretty extraordinary. This isn't an extraordinary happening that we're all involved in. And yet our human nature takes it for granted, like it does have a kitchen, you know? It's like, oh yeah, well, okay, it's dark tonight, it's light in the morning, this is all normal and regular. And we forget the wonder and just the absurdity of it, of being alive and being here. How extraordinarily rare. When you finally arrive at the place of the genuine way, it is like great space, vast and open. In another translation, it says, when you finally arrive at the place of no doubt. So I'd have to see how this is translated. And I like that more than this translation I'm using here, to arrive at the place of no doubt, because usually that's at the core for every Dharma practitioner, is try as we may, there's just some doubt. There's just something there that just keeps us from really swallowing this down. Something that just holds us back from really opening up. And that's why we practice. That's why we meet on Tuesday evenings and Sunday mornings and do retreats, in order to keep going, Because this is not a practice that, you know, this is a multi-year, multi-decade, and in some aspect, you know, depending on your tradition, multi-lifetime endeavor, in order to really to uncover and realize this Buddha mind. Yeah, it's just such a curious life to be both mortal and divine, right? In the sense of there's me, I, and my story, which began and will end in this particular realm or sphere or whatever you call this that we're in. And yet all of us are a part of something which was here before we got here. And we're like, and we'll be here long after we're not here, as this I, me form, you know? And like, what is this? What is this life and this way that is continued without gap? We serve the same mind as Joshu, the same mind as Nansen, the same mind as Dogen and the Buddha and everyone else. Yeah, and some Dharma practitioners, they really penetrate to great depth and they're able to express in a wonderful way. And good for them, you know? It's good that some people have that depth of realization. But if we hold ourselves apart and say, well, they've got it and I don't, and so I'm poorer than them, That's a mistake. That demeans the one that we are, the Buddha that we are. That demeans how you understand how you are now when it's compared to an idea of something or someone else. You know, really have, I encourage us all, have real faith that as you are, the one that you are, as you are now, here now, this is both the beginning and the end of the journey. You know, not becoming someone else, something else. It's a beautiful thing when you can to really to swallow that down. There's nowhere to go. There's no one to be. Nothing to achieve. Yeah, but a stepping back. And a letting go. It's curious, as a human being, especially in our culture, we're conditioned to cultivate gain. And we come to Zen or Dharma practice, and we cultivate loss. But the loss that we cultivate, right, is all the things that we grasp and cling to. All of the false dawns and the things that we think will be enough or will make us happy. And it's only in emptying our hands and emptying our hearts and letting everything go that we can really find refuge in the one that is complete, home, at home, and at peace, and is free. Okay, I'm going to pause. I said I'd leave some time, and then I just...